Today, some advantages, disadvantages, and support for democracy.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
The topic, I mean, may seem a little sacrosanct. Democracy, I mean, after all, it's a basic value. And it is a basic value. I think it ought to remain a basic value. Part of the value of understanding how important democracy is to us, though, is in recognizing how important it is that we see its weaknesses and address those, not just criticize it and try to replace it with something. I don't think there is anything to replace it with that would be better. I am as fundamentally and completely committed to ideas of democratic rule as a person can be. I just can't see a better way forward. I understand there are arguments to be made by people on extreme sides about why democratic processes are not so great. I understand that, and that therefore leads them to conclude that we ought to be looking for a different system. I don't think that's the case at all. I think observing the weaknesses in something give us an opportunity to address those weaknesses. And if it's in something which is, in my view, and I think it ought to be in our view, the best solution for how we exercise rule within communities, and democracy is that, then we ought to use our observation of those weaknesses to improve it. And we shouldn't have our head in the sand and pretend like there are not weaknesses. So let me come at this, and obviously this is going to be a cursory dealing with issues around democracy. I don't mean for it to be systematic in the sense of saying, as a political scientist, in fact, I would, if I were going to do that, I would invite Dr. Brandon Seitzler, our political scientist with his PhD, to come and talk about the details of the political system and why we should look at the weaknesses in the order that we should look at and so on. That's not the point here. There is a particular weakness built into democracy, and it's inherent to democracy. This doesn't take rocket science to figure out, or a PhD. The weakness of democracy is people. That's what democracy is about, people ruling, and people are problematic. So that's obviously the weakness, and I want to talk about that. There are also huge advantages to it. So what I want to do is, because I want to address that particular weakness that's in the nature of human beings and how they express their will, and the inherent association between that, therefore, and democracy, because that's what people are doing in democracy. The democratic expressions can have a lot of different forms, including Republican forms, not the party, but the form that would be expressed through indirect democracy instead of direct democracy, and different forms of each of those, and so on. So I just mean democracy broadly, the idea that the rule is still coming bottom up from the people in some way. I understand the elitism and meritocracy arguments and all the things that go with saying even when you pretend it's democratic, it's not really. I get it. That's part of the weakness of democracy that we should recognize and address. And yet it's still democratic in comparison with, for instance, and most obviously in the modern era, totalitarian regimes of some kind. Okay. So I'm already arguing with people, and there's nobody even in here to argue with. Okay. So anyway, what I want to do is just talk about a couple of advantages that inherently go with democracy and why it should be preserved is basically what I mean by this. The advantage of democracy is the value that it brings and the value that we need to preserve. And then describe what I think are inherent disadvantages in democracy and the weaknesses that go with it, all so that in the end, we can talk about some undergirding, some solutions, some recommendations and thoughts we ought to have in order to preserve our democracy and just to recognize that democracies in general can be preserved. So the advantages of democracy, by which, again, I just mean the ideological advantage of being in a democracy. And so I'll start with that, the ideological advantage of being in a democracy. And so obviously what I'm going to do is talk about ideological advantages and practical advantages to being in a democracy. The ideological advantages are the promotion that it provides for equality, the emphasis being on equality. And I understand that we could say, well, socialism doesn't have to be democratic and socialism promotes equality. And there are some great de Tocqueville quotes. Maybe they're accurate. Maybe they're misattributed about that, that make a point that that's a claim of equality, but it's equality imposed by an unequal leadership of some kind. And so I just don't put that in the same category. But again, I understand you could make an argument for that. But in terms of genuine democratic values that are inherent in the nature of the term, that the people are going to rule, the people are the ones who are making the judgments. And again, this is the ideal. So it's ideological. I understand there are problems. We'll talk about those in a minute. But the ideology of saying, you know, all of us have a voice. Every person gets one vote. Even after you're elected president, you go into the ballot box, you still get one vote. This is part of the reality, even if we're pretending everybody's abusing that, they're not. It's a fair and real election that's taking place. A few people try to do bad things, but they don't get to take over the election. Our elections are meaningful, and we should be grateful for how beautifully run they are. We know the people who run them. It's part of our democracy, our neighbors. I have a person in my small group who is the judge over elections for the Republican Party in one of the counties around here. So it's these are people we know. So we are really blessed to have elections, and the elections are so valuable because they're part of the expression that we think everybody should have an equal voice. So ideologically, that's rooted for those of us who are followers of Jesus, those of us who are religious in our commitments, especially in the Judaistic tradition or Christian tradition, because people bear the image of God, and every person bears the image of God. And so they have a representation in the society that makes them equal with everyone else. That is being the representation of God in this world. But even if you did it from a non-religious perspective, our enlightenment, being informed by the enlightenment, we think of human nature itself as demanding a certain amount of respect, including equal representation in the society. Even if you're going to be different in what you can contribute to the society or what you're able to understand in the society, you still get equal representation. So if you can be a football player and make millions of dollars because everybody wants to watch you on the field, or if you can't, if you can be a mathematician and solve problems nobody else can solve, or if you can't, you still get one vote. Not because you're a smart mathematician, not because you're a brilliant or a fantastic football player. You could be both. I'm not saying you can't be both. I'm just trying to emphasize brawn and brains, right, separately, not that they can't be together. Oh, I'm being way too defensive in this. The point is, because you're human, you get a vote, not because you're a football player or a mathematician. So that, I've expressed this so many different times in different episodes, on the radio for 10 years before this, that human life is only valued to the extent that every single human life is valued. That's why I'm offering the invocation at Involved for Life's gala this Friday. As I'm recording it, it's this coming Friday. It will already have happened after this airs. But the meaning of that statement is human life is only as valuable as we make the application of that value to every single human life. Otherwise, we are picking and choosing who's valuable, not because they're human, but because of what they give to us in some way. So if we don't value human life simply, merely, in C.S. Lewis's kinds of language and a lot of people's language, if we don't value human life merely because it is human, then we don't value any human life because it's human. So it's important that we value equality, even from an Enlightenment perspective, without the argument of the image of God, which, of course, I believe in to begin with. If we don't do that, if we don't assign that human value to everyone, then we become utilitarians. We just use people for what they provide for us. And when they don't provide that anymore, they can be discarded. Or we don't care about them at all as individuals in that kind of context. So equality is one of the ideological issues that comes to bear on why democracy is so valuable to us. The other, which is very closely tied to this, they're inseparable, is the idea of rights. And a lot of people don't understand, and it's not because they don't grasp it intellectually, but they've just never had to think through this particular question. But rights are only for individuals. Rights are not owned by corporations or governments. Governments don't have rights. Societies don't have rights. Individuals have rights. That's how the word is used. It's about liberties for individuals to be able to express those liberties. And we have taken and started to talk about corporate rights and obligations and things like that. But that language is really just a sort of metaphorical or analogical with what it means for individuals to have rights. So in this case, when you understand what rights are about, all it comes down to mean is that social privilege, like can you go into that store? Can you buy these kinds of products? Can you get married? And this, whatever. Can you get this kind of job? Social privilege is universally available. And again, we just are so casual with our language, which is normal. We're so casual with it, we don't think about what available means. It doesn't just mean it's over there and the door is open. It means a person can make avail of it. They are able to take advantage of it. It doesn't mean they have to take advantage of it. They don't have to do it. But it is there and available to them. They can get there if they want to. And there are lots of questions to ask about where those barriers exist and don't exist, and whether, for instance, an economic or social barrier that exists not in law, but just in common practice, is also something that should be eliminated in a free society. I think those arguments ought to be had, and we will always quibble about exactly where that line goes. But the fact is, in a society where we recognize every human being as being valuable, we give the same rights of social privilege to every human being in that society. We don't do that very effectively, admittedly, but we should, and we know we should. And so ideologically, that's one of the advantages of being in a democracy. In the same way, social prohibition is universally applicable, meaning if you're going to make a rule that somebody can't do something, you make it for everybody. You don't have water fountains that are labeled for one group of people not to be able to drink them. If a water fountain can't be drunk by one person, it can't be drunk by anybody. That's the whole thing. Social prohibitions are universally applicable. So ideologically, we all agree. I mean, again, in practice, do we get there? Maybe not. And I'm certain we don't, but we work on it and we try to become better and better. We're in a fallen world, or our world is a mess. It's a work in progress, however you want to think about it. The reality is we probably don't get there, but we know we should. We know we ought to have those things at the core of how we think about how we relate to other people. And honestly, I don't know anybody who would disagree with that. They want to get there. I do know people who don't agree with it in practice. And I try to go at ways to convince and persuade and expose the need and so on. But that's on the practical side. So let's talk about the practical side for just a second. Again, these are just advantages to being in a democracy. This is why it should be so important to us to preserve our democracy and to preserve democratic ideals, right, for the way that we live. On the practical side, it just seems such a great waste of human talent to trap individuals in the inept plans of a few elite decision makers who are inherently incapable of processing enough information to get the same advantage that would come from everybody contributing freely to what they're going to offer to society because of their interests and gifts and talents and skills and so on like that. This is the argument there's just so many people, from Hayek to Wilhelm von Humboldt. I'm using his book, The Limits of State Action, this semester in a course on political theory. And it's a book that's published by libertarians. And I've mentioned it in here before. I'm in the studio, you know, where I record these episodes. So that's what I mean. Wilhelm von Humboldt wrote this book, The Limits of State Action, you know, in response to all the revolutions that were taking place, to the overthrow of the standard form of what they were coming to understand as order in the nation state and had understood for a millennium and more, which was something about royalty and divine right and so on. And when you're overthrowing the king in France and when the social order is in tumult, you're trying to figure out what we're going to do to have a stable society. And in that society, he's the one who makes, and the title of the book kind of tells you the conclusion, The Limits of State Action, meaning the more the government from the top down tries to dictate what everyone's going to do, the less efficient the society is going to be at maximizing the benefit it gets from its population. Because we're just not good at seeing what other people are good at. We need them in their interests and skills to sort of naturally flow into the areas where their talents can benefit society in the best way. I know that's extremely free market oriented. It's extremely libertarian. That's why the book is published by libertarians so often. And yet it's a compelling argument. There is something legitimate about saying to someone, well, do you love doing that? How about doing that for the rest of your life and doing it really well for the rest of your life? That's not the same as spiritual gifts. I don't say this about spiritual gifts. I don't believe this about spiritual gifts. I'm talking about how a person contributes to a free society. And in that free society, you get levels of prosperity. And I don't mean that in just a materialistic way. I mean levels of accomplishment and satisfaction that you just can't get in any other way. The contrast that is maybe trivial at this point, but true, is between what is happening in the United States, again, where we don't realize it ideally by any stretch of the imagination during the mid-20th century, but we are at least attempting to provide a free space for people to become what they want to become. And again, I'm not saying everybody's included in that, but if you contrast that with what was going on in the totalitarian regimes, the level of productivity and prosperity and wealth and commitment from the population to the cause and all of those things is just off the charts. There's no legitimate comparison to be made except to say we had an absurd advantage. And so I love that idea. And if you read, an Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whom I've mentioned in a couple of episodes recently as well, whether it's in the Gulag Archipelago or in the First Circle, you get a picture of what that looks like when inept leadership is trying, and it's inept by its nature, not because some people are just not bright, but by its nature, you can't grasp all the things that would allow human creativity to flourish if you're just controlling everything with this tight grip from the top. So reading an Alexander Solzhenitsyn, something really gets that point across. I understand the bias that he has, but I understand that he earned that bias as well. Okay, so anyway, so practically, there's the advantage of a better use of the human talent that you have in your society. There's also, and partially as a result of that, you get this way of thinking about democracy in practical terms in our world that are completely different from the way of understanding what the expression of democracy was, say, in ancient Greece. Never lived in ancient Greece. I know you'll find that hard to believe at my age, but I never did. I'm talking about it from having read it in how Plato describes it and how ancient Greeks described it, right? So in ancient Greece, what democracy was really about was the obligation of every qualified citizen, and qualified is prejudicial and it's bigoted and all of those things that go with being a part of ancient Greece, okay? I acknowledge all of that, but the best they could think about, well, it's not the best, but the way they thought about democracy, it was this. It was the obligation of every qualified citizen to participate in ordering that city. It's not what it is for us. And so, again, people get really confused about this, and they think, well, democracy's been around since Greece, you know, so we've been practicing. Well, I mean, the structural element of democracy has been around since then. But for them, democracy was defined by the social obligation of all of the citizens to participate in ruling the city. And it was rotating and all that kind of stuff. But in modern days, the focus is on the freedom of every citizen or every individual to express their own desire for whatever the ordering of the city is going to be. That is, democracy for us is about voting. It's not about ruling. It's not about having to sit in Congress for a season. It's not about having to serve on the city council. It's about being able to choose someone to do it. You say, well, that's because it's an indirect democracy. Partially, but it's that. Partially because we want to say to people, hey, you don't want to do it. You don't have to do it. You don't have to do anything you don't want to do. You're an individual. And I am saying that like a pandering person, but I'm also saying it genuinely. We respect the rights of individuals who don't want to serve on a city council, not to have to serve on the city council. Hey, just go vote. You'll fulfill your obligation. But even that, in practical terms, the reality that our modern expression of democracy is in individualism is obvious in the fact that when people, individuals, don't vote, we sort of try to shame them. Shame on you for not voting. You can't talk about whether you like the president or not because you didn't even vote. How could you do that? And the argument may be legitimate. I'm not having that argument today. I know you say you're having every argument today. Why not have it? That's not my point. My point is to say that shame that we put on people or the pride. I voted, you know, put the sticker on. I voted, which is great. I'm happy people do that. I want civic responsibility to be promoted in our culture. But those are impositions on the individual who might say, you know, I don't want to vote. I don't want to wait in line at the library. Or I just don't like any of the candidates. Or I don't like the way our political system works, so I'm not going to vote. Whatever it is that gives them a reason to do it, we say, nah, we really want to put pressure on you to participate. Come on now, participate. That's the closest we get to making it a corporate expression of leadership in our communities. Ancient Greece, that wouldn't even have been a question. That wasn't the thing. But for us, democracy is about individualism. And so you have that irony of voting to represent your individual interest. And yet that vote is your responsibility, your civic duty, an expression of your community identity, and so on. So there's an irony in there. I think all of that is a huge advantage to being in a modern democratic society and ought to be preserved. Because even the reminder that we are part of the society comes inherently with the respect that we give to the individual who can vote or not vote. Nobody shows up at his house with a gun and says, you have to vote right now. I want you to vote. You've got the choices there, Putin and no one. Make your choice, Putin or no one. Okay, you circle it. Okay, you voted now. Putin won the election. What do you know? Okay, that's the advantage. Now, the disadvantage to democracy, and I wanted to start with the advantage because I love democracy, but we have to admit there are some problems built into saying to any community, hey, y'all just rule yourselves and let's see how this goes. Just how is that going to turn out? You know, anywhere in the world, how is that going to turn out? Well, as it turns out here, it's been fantastic, amazing, but we should recognize where it hasn't been, where there have been some weaknesses. And I'm not out to pick on America today. It's not us. It's the nature of democracy. It's the nature of people and how they are. And so I'll give a couple of examples that'll be touchy, but they're just examples to say, even here, we experience this reality. So here's the first part of the serious disadvantage to democracy. And like I said, it's just people. People are a disadvantage because people are not perfect. Individuals who are making individualistic judgments in their self-interest, but making those judgments for the sake of the whole community, that can be a problem. And so, I mean, on the funny side, to exemplify this, is that scene in Men in Black, the movie, you know, from the 90s, whenever it came out 30 years ago or however long ago it was, where Tommy Lee Jones is explaining to Will Smith why they don't tell people about the aliens, you know, that we've encountered in the world. They're sitting on a park bench or a bench looking out over a river or something like that. I can't remember the details. But it's a really funny line, and it's always kind of been in the back of my head as, sort of true and sort of false. It depends on what you mean by it. But the truth of it is something relevant here. And so what he says is, you know, Will Smith is sitting there, and he's dumbfounded that, oh, lo and behold, they're aliens. You know, I hate to be a spoiler if you've never seen Men in Black, but I mean, let's be realistic. If you haven't seen it, you're not going to see it now. And if you have seen it, you know this scene. So Will Smith, you know, he's just learning there are aliens in the world, and he's just dumbfounded by it. And Tommy Lee Jones is trying to talk to him, explain to him why this is, and nobody knows, you know. And Will Smith is, just tell people. They can handle it. They're smart. You know, it's not a problem. And Tommy Lee Jones's response is, persons are smart. People are dumb, panicky, and you know it. You know, it's a great line, and it's really a true line. If, and this is where I think it's right, if you're talking about mobs, you know, people acting in groups, and let me explain what I mean by a mob, is a group of people who are acting on atavistic impulses, which is pretty, they're atavistic, so they're built into us, you know, that, the primitive types of impulses, that kind of thing. And they're doing it without thoughtful leadership. It doesn't mean there's not leadership. There is always leadership in a group. But it's without considered leadership. You know, well, who do we really want to follow here? It's not that. If you're in a mob, you know, you're not saying, oh, well, let's have a quick election. Can we get a vote here? Who's the smart one? And who's the strong one? And then who's the one who's done some politics? Okay, I like this guy. So how about that? Is that all right? I mean, by the time you finish doing that, you've been trampled to death. So if you're in a mob, you don't have good leadership, and you're just acting on the group impulses that are going on, which are pretty atavistic. I learned this. I'm embarrassed to tell this even now, and this was 52 years ago when I was 9 years old. I'm embarrassed. I've never told this story. Now, I'm not even going to tell you all the details because it's too bad. So when I was 9 years old, I was playing on a soccer team. And I was standing on the sideline, and we were playing a team that we thought was doing us wrong, you know? And when you're 9 years old, injustice can be very significant, even if it's just they got away with, you know, some kind of hands or something, you know, touching the ball with the hands. I don't remember what they were doing, but they were doing something we didn't like. And I'm just part of the team. I was on the sideline, you know, so how important am I to the team? I'm not. But to me, it was important. This is part of my group. I'm on the sideline. And the team got, I mean, really irate. 9-year-olds, how irate can you get? But for us, it was as irate as you could get. And we were screaming at the other team, and I'm just watching my teammates, and I'm like, okay, I'm in, you know? And so I'm as mad as you can possibly be as a 9-year-old human being, screaming terrible things to the other team. And I remember the word blood being involved. You know, I'm so embarrassed just to tell this. I feel this to this day. And I happened to glance back toward the stands and saw some people on the stands. I don't even remember whether they were adults or kids. I don't even remember. But I remember seeing a face kind of slack-jawed, looking at all of us like, what are y'all doing? That is, and thinking to myself, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? I don't dislike those guys. What happened to me? And I have no idea whether that shaped the rest of me or if my response to that was just evidence of the kind of personality I happen to have. But I just, you know, from there on, I've never been a part of a mob. I just don't do anything like that. And I mean it in terms of concerts or congregational worship. If somebody tells somebody in the congregation, hey, just stand up if you want to, I'm like, I'm out. I'm just going to sit here and y'all do what you want to do, but I'm not participating in the mob. If everybody stands up, I'm going to sit down. That's not a good attitude. I'm not saying it's a good attitude. I'm just saying it's sort of built into me because I recognized that, and I've said this before recently, you know, people will do things in a group and especially in a mob that they would never do individually. And that's a dangerous thing. And democracy is an invitation to participate in that in a lot of ways. Now, think about the expand. I'm still just talking about mobs here for a minute. Think about the expansive effect that has. That when a mob starts behaving in a certain way, I mean, look, as an analogy, and actually it is an example of this in some ways, you can just think back on the paparazzi chasing around Princess Diana, always wanting to get a picture. And then the tragic end to that is in an episode where a member of the royal family and her boyfriend and a driver, a professional driver, are acting like rabbits being pursued by wolves to their own demise. They end up dying because they lose control, because they're trying so ferocious when you're the prey, to get away desperately. That's it, to get away. That behavior of the mob expands beyond the mob to everyone who's influenced by it, so that the responses, and this is just structurally built into us as beings, much less human beings, that we start behaving like those who have to respond to a mob, and we start doing the stuff that's necessary there. Think of a century of lynchings in the United States. Just here, the 2,000 lynchings that took place in the South and the North between the end of the Civil War and the 12 or so years after that, when, you know, you're trying to impose freedom for people who are still under the thumb of a society that's not going to give them freedom. And so terror is used to sort of suppress the behavior of that population. And because after a dozen years or so, the federal government essentially gave up and said, well, we're never going to be able to impose the kinds of voting rights and genuine equality that we want for black citizens in America, so we're just going to back away from it. We gave into almost 100 more years of legitimate encoded Jim Crow South segregation and terror, 4,400 more lynchings that are documented, much less the ones that don't have documentation during that time as well. An example of which, I know what you're thinking is, a few rogue individuals go do these bad things. You really need to rethink how you consider where lynchings went in America. I'm not saying this because I hate America. I love America. I love what we're trying to be as a democracy. I'm saying it so that you'll remember how dangerous a population is when it's in control of itself. And this is what happened. A perfect example is this famous picture in Waco, Texas, in 1916, of the lynching of Jesse Washington. And he's convicted by a white jury in 4 minutes, whether he's guilty or not, and ends up being lynched there. And there's a famous photograph. I will link to it or give you a link to a site where you can find it. It's wacohistory.org is where I looked it up. There are several pictures there. But if you'll find the picture that shows the crowd that has gathered around of 20,000 people or so to watch this man tortured to death, then you'll understand that it's not that why I'm talking about it here, that the weakness in democracy is that it's run by people, because people, when they're running themselves, will run like a mob, and it's dangerous. Now, we recognize that, and so we address it. And in fact, that photograph and some other things that came out of that event in Waco became part of the national movement that said we have to do something to stop this. So thank God, literally, for that. But the reality is, we're scary. People are scary when you give us the power. And democracy, by its definition, gives us the power. And so what you have to look to is the different ways leadership expresses itself in the democracy, or in this case, a mob, you know, and how a mob behaves. And by the way, in a mob, you're motivated by atavistic impulses, but your leadership is either going to be not there at all. And again, it's always there implicitly, but, you know, a group without a head, so a decapitated group, the direction is, amorphous and yet powerful, and it does take a form in the end. And so that's why, you know, concert goers end up being crushed by people who are trying to rush the doors to get in, or people who are at a soccer game or a football game somewhere, you know, and we hear about it all the time, you know, 20 people crushed as this event takes place. Nobody's saying, hey, let's crush some of the participants. And yet the crowd is doing it. Because when you don't have any leadership, that's what's going to happen. The other kind of leadership is impromptu, and it's just somebody stands up and starts providing direction. But that's a person who wants to run a mob, and they're not going to provide the leadership that suppresses those impulses that the mob is trying to express. They're going to organize it into something that's even more effective at the chaos that's being brought about. Okay, so you get the idea. So the this is the reason that people are a weakness in democracy. It's not complicated. It's the inherent nature of people to need what they don't want. And that's built into us as individuals. That's pretty obvious. Because if we did want it in the context of all the implications that it brings, we would already be doing it. We'd already be pursuing it. We would already be allowing it. But we don't really want it, even when we say we do. And that's embedded in us as individuals. I've talked about it in a number of episodes as psychological egoism. The phrase, you can only want what you want. You know, you can say, well, I'm going to choose something I don't even want. I mean, when you choose it, you want it. So you can only want what you want. And I'm not a psychological egoist. I'm just telling you how compelling this reality is in us. We still have to deal with this truth. So either, if you understand this in the individual, you end up choosing something freely because it was the only choice you really had, because that's the thing you actually did want, or you're not actually acting freely. You had a spasm, or you had a compulsion of some kind, an addiction or something else like that, and your freedom's gone. In reality, you can only want what you want as an individual. Now, I'm saying that, again, to talk about the harsh side of this. I do believe in libertarian will. However, in communitarian ways, the nature of this weakness, that we don't end up wanting what we need or accepting the thing that we actually need from those who could provide it. And so in ruling ourselves as a people, we never get to where we ought to be. In communitarian ways, that shows up a little differently than psychological egoism. So I don't think it is as simple as what de Tocqueville says. You know, the famous quote from de Tocqueville is, "The American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money." Congress and presidents have been doing that actively and openly, claiming credit for it for more than a century. And I'm saying more, I'm just not going beyond that, but I know we can start from the beginning of the 20th century and just count them off, the number of times this has happened. And yet, here we are. And we're not a moderate community in our world society. I mean, you know, we're the leading force in this world society. So we're here. I just don't think it's as simple as de Tocqueville's claim. And by the way, all my libertarian friends out there, we probably ought to stop quoting that as if it's the end-all and be-all of knowledge about democracy's weakness. And by the way, there are a lot of reasons it doesn't immediately follow that just because in COVID we give $1 trillion to our population, which is just absurd. So whatever. In COVID we give all this money to our population, and yet the economy doesn't collapse. Lo and behold, employment's going up, the stock market's going up, everything's looking fairly good. It's like, what's wrong with this picture? Something's wrong with it. I'm acknowledging that. Something's wrong with this picture. And yet here we are, getting better, and things are going well. I mean, we have to stop the sky is falling crying out every time something like that happens. But I will say this, the weakness that does come, in the sense of us as a community, as a nation, as a people who vote, either as a state or a local community or a nation, it does show up in terms of these two prominent weaknesses. Number one is pandering and sophistic leadership. What I mean, you know what I mean by that? Pandering leadership. I mean, everybody sees that. I'm just going to say whatever you want to hear, and you can, I believe in you, you know, whatever. The pandering kind of leadership that we see in politics, and it is there all the time. I say sophistic because that's how Plato describes it. And it's the kind that is a finger to the air to try to feel where the currents of the population want to go. And I'll go with you. I'll lead you. Let me catch up with you. And I'll lead you where you're already going. It's that kind of leadership. So pandering, sophistic leadership. And then the other way it shows up is in a fickle electorate. So you can elect people with conviction. You can elect people who care. But the electorate just yanks back and forth from one election to the next, and you never know where they're going to be. And the reason for the difference in whether you're, you know, having pandering, sophisticated leadership or fickle electorate, and you can obviously have both, but you don't need to if you have pandering leadership, is that when you have that kind of pandering leadership, when you have self-serving leadership, the only goal is to retain your authority. So you say whatever the crowd wants to hear so you can get elected. And you may want to retain your authority with this some delusional commitment to the public good in your mind. Well, I'm going to give them what they really need, but I'm going to tell them what they want to hear, you know, kind of thought, which is pure hypocrisy and completely wrong. And you should get out of politics if you do that and stop doing it. But anyway, or you're simply doing it because you want to continue to have an income and it's a way for you to have money. And there are plenty of politicians who do that too. We all know them. That's an option, that we have self-serving leadership in that kind of world, and that's a weakness in democracy. And why do we get it? Because people want to hear what they want to hear. They have itching ears, as we say it in the scriptures, right? In the book to Timothy, in the letter that Paul writes to Timothy, having itching ears. We don't want to satisfy those itching ears, but, you know, sometimes as politicians, it might be the thing to do so you can get elected. Then you become the person that's scratching the itching ears. That kind of leadership is a problem that comes not because politicians are bad, but because democracy has a weakness of being run by people. And that's just how we are as human beings. And the second one is having a fickle electorate. Now, think about this one. You see, this would be the consequence of having a leader who actually has some kind of commitment, some kind of conviction. And it can be a moral conviction or not. So I don't mean they're, you know, this is an outstanding person with moral convictions and Christian values. I'm not saying that. In fact, I would put Trump and Carter in the same category in this way. They both have extreme convictions. Trump about what he wants to do with government and society, which you can argue about what you think that is and whether it's good or bad, all you want. But he's, I mean, the man is committed to leading in one direction, and he's going to go that direction no matter what. And Jimmy Carter was actually the same way, completely different direction, but had the same kinds of convictions. And what did we end up with both of them? One-term presidencies. Why is that? Because people elect them saying, oh, we need that. Let's get that. We need somebody like Jimmy Carter to sort of kick back against the Gerald Ford, Richard Nixon, Watergate scandal and crookedness of the, we want somebody with so much integrity that they're a Sunday school teacher and they're going to spend the rest of their life. We didn't know this at the time, but this is what they did. Building houses for the poor, for crying out loud. We want somebody like that. We want them until they sit down and say, hey, let me tell you the hard truth here. We've got some things we need to do. And I need you to be smart about how you're driving and how much energy you're using. Because as a people, we just don't have all the prosperity we thought we had. We're still strong. We can get there, blah, blah, blah. People hear that. It's true. They want to follow it. But when somebody shows up and says, I have a bright future for you, and you can put all this malaise behind you, then we'd rather have that, and we'd rather move in that direction. And I'm not against Ronald Reagan. I think there are a lot of great things to say about Ronald Reagan. But, you know, if you speak with conviction the truth that people need to hear and not what they want to hear, odds are you're going to be president for one term. That's just how it's going to go. The people who voted for Trump were doing the same thing. They believed in something. They wanted it to happen. But then when it happened, enough of them said, this isn't what I really bargained for. That's not what I want. That they voted for Biden. They voted for Joe Biden after that, who is diametrically opposite of Donald Trump. You can't go from Donald Trump to Joe Biden and the possibility of going back without recognizing that we've got a fickle electorate, right? So we have some people who are ensconced on one end or the other. We have a lot of fickle people in the middle. Okay, I'm saying all of that to say, well, so there's a disadvantage to democracy, which is that people run the country. You know, I mean, I think it's the best solution for all the people to run the country, but it's still got its weaknesses. How do we address those weaknesses? So I'm going to do this briefly, and we've talked about these principles enough in other episodes that I don't need to spend any time on this. I'm going to give you 5 minutes or less of a solution. It's not a solution. It's a resolution to this discussion. It's a way for us to constantly make improvements. It's a way for us to give attention to the weaknesses of democracy and not just give up on it. And the attention is simple. I'm taking this from all of the books I've read by Hannah Arendt, my hero, my heroine, however you want to say it, she's just a fantastic political scientist, sociologist, ethicist from the 20th century. Highly recommend that you read whatever you can get your hands on from her. Anyway, as I've read Hannah Arendt, I think this is the thing that has to be in place for us to attend to these weaknesses. And it's just voluntary associations. It's super simple. Voluntary associations, meaning we need to be part of organizations that we feel obligated to. Church is one of those. And I mean that broadly. I don't just mean become a Christian and join a church. Do that. If you don't know Christ, become a Christian. If you don't understand forgiveness and the new life that he gives because of what he offered that we celebrated in the resurrection of Easter, then come to Christ. And become, as you become a Christian, you'll realize becoming a part of the community that's in Christ in a church is transformative to your life and gives a stability to your life it just does not have otherwise. So I strongly encourage that. But outside of that, I'm saying to you, you need to be part of organizations that inform you with stability and constancy about the values that go beyond just you as an individual and help you make decisions when you're in the voting booth, for instance, or when you're down at City Hall talking about some issue that needs to be decided that go beyond just the selfishness that we have as individuals. The difference that Hannah Arendt describes between the American Revolution and the stability that came from it and the French Revolution and the instability that came from it is the strength and stability of the political and governmental and state, and we don't use that word very accurately anymore, entities, which persisted through the American Revolution. They were lost in many ways, and they were weak and sort of disorganized or disorganized, I'll just say, in the French Revolution. And so you had revolution after revolution after counter-revolution and so on. But in America, it was different. We were talking about colonial legislatures who were making these decisions and who still had authority within their regions when the Americans were fighting the revolution against Great Britain. It wasn't just individuals with pitchforks who said, kill King George. It was legislatures who sat down representing the will of the people and representing the stability of leadership that comes from those kinds of elections who made the decision that we were going to participate in the revolution. And I'm not even talking about a revolution here. I'm simply talking about what I see lost in the way we think about our democracy as if I myself need to go storm the Capitol building if we don't win the election we want to win. What we need to recognize is that there is a stability and value that brings moderation to the rule of the people, which comes in the form of what people hate now. They talk about the deep state. The deep state is just the state. It's just the presence of a bureaucracy and these slow-moving wheels that represent the diachronic interest of 250 years of a nation's existence, not just the last 4 years of a political entity that was in power. And when we recognize that value, that there is an advantage to the disadvantage of bureaucracy. There is an advantage to the fact that that person behind the counter at the DPS is going to take 30 minutes to get your driver's license ready. If you work for DPS, I apologize for the caricature. You're doing fantastic work. We're really grateful for you, and please don't take it out on me when I come to the DPS. You guys do great work. Anyway, the point is, I appreciate that. The reality is you need that kind of bureaucracy to keep us from being the kind of people who just grab somebody off the street and lynch them because we think they violated our interest. We need that kind of stability. We need to be members of these organizations and a part of bodies that help us think through those things. And as you think through those things, and for me, the church is obviously the most important one. And it's most important because of where its values are rooted and because of how they're expressed, because I am a Christian. I do follow Christ. Looking for leadership that has conviction and also cares for people outside of themselves, the value of the state that I just talked about, the resolution of individual rights with social obligations, all of those things can bring to a democracy that's run by fallible people a strength and blessing that ought to make us drop to our knees and give God thanks every day for the democracy he's given us here in the United States.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.